You're listening to the Portland Art Museum podcast. I'm Grace Cook Anderson, the Arlene and Harold Schnitzer Curator of Northwest Art. On the previous episode, we heard from Jenny Irene Miller, a photographer based in Anchorage, Alaska, whose work is featured in our current exhibition, The Map is Not the Territory. On this episode, we hear from Fernanda D'Agostino, a Portland-based video and performance artist. If you've listened to previous episodes, you'll notice that the usual music isn't playing. Rather, you are listening to the sounds you would experience if you were walking through Borderline, Fernanda's contribution to The Map is Not the Territory. It's an immersive and interactive video installation that fills Portland Art Museum's entire sculpture court, the area you encounter as you first enter the museum. Two giant, semi-opaque drapes hang from the ceiling, and each have video not only projected onto them, but also through them. They depict footage of government surveillance, forest fires, weather emergencies, and Fernanda's collaborators in elaborate movement and dance. Cameras in the sculpture court also insert outlines of museum visitors within the projections. There is also a smaller circular projection on the floor that features two of Fernanda's collaborators cramped into the confines of the projected light. But spending time in the exhibition only tells part of the story. For the rest, here is Fernanda D'Agostino.
My name is Fernanda D'Agostino, and I am a video installation artist. And I started doing installations in 1984 after spending 3 months in Italy and realizing that seeing art the way we do in the United States in these sort of pristine white boxes is really not what the fullest experience that you could have. And I realized that I wanted to recreate this experience that I had of seeing art in a more immersive context for American viewers. And it was sort of towards the beginning of installation art. And I just became totally fascinated with putting people inside my artwork. About 10 years ago, now it's 20 years ago, I started working with video as a way of putting a time-based element into my pieces. And about 10 years ago, I started working with creative coding after being at a festival in China and meeting someone that was working with coding. And that has been really transformational for me because it's allowed me to create a more nuanced time-based work and also to put the viewer inside the work in a really different way than I had been in the past. Still having the viewer be inside the work as a body moving through space, but then also being able to put them in the work as a part of a moving image. So when I started working with creative code, I had, previous to that, I had been working with video loops in my installations. And I was achieving randomness by making the loops be different lengths so that things were never pairing up exactly the same. But at the time I began working with creative coding, I was really interested in memory and how memory operates. And I had a friend who was a scientist who was studying the nature of memory from a scientific and sort of neurological perspective. And he was telling me that every time you remember something, you remember it differently. The more frequently you revisit a memory, the less accurate it becomes, which is really counterintuitive. But it's because your mind is experiencing these different things simultaneously with the memory, and you tend to conflate those things. And so the memory shifts over time. And the most accurate memory is one where you wake up in the middle of the night and say, oh, I suddenly remembered when I was 5 years old and this happened. That could be really accurate. But the ones that you're thinking about all the time tend to shift. And so I was really interested in states of mind. And when I did my first big show using creative coding, it was at the art gym, and it was called, The Method of Loci, which is this sort of method from classical times of pre-writing, where you could remember these complicated things. And the curator, Terry Hopkins, said that it was like being inside my mind. And if you think about time from a mental, how we experience time, it's not really at all like a beginning, middle, and end. We revisit things. There's this sort of stream of consciousness where one idea is flowing into another one, and then maybe you circle back to the first one, or maybe you circle back to one that's, you know, months earlier. And we're sort of constructing time all the time. And we've all had the experience of time slowing down and time speeding up psychologically. And I think what coding has allowed me to do is to create work that uses time-based medium, but in a way that is more analogous to the way we actually experience time, which isn't in such a... I mean, we all construct narratives in order to keep ourselves from going crazy, but actually our experience of time is much more fluid. And so that's what I'm interested in with these things.
One thing that's interesting about Fernanda's work, Borderline, especially, is that it expands the definition of what it means for media to be time-based. Using creative coding, Fernanda's work seamlessly loops at random and is essentially endless. It's things like this that intrigue me about Fernanda. And to best understand her as an artist, it's important to know more about her ancestry and upbringing.
Well, I was born in Trenton, New Jersey. I come from an immigrant family. My grandfather immigrated in 1900, and he was an illiterate contract laborer. And he lived in a boxcar for 10 years with a labor crew, with a padrone, until he could save up enough money to bring my aunt or my grandmother to the United States. So I have that background, and you know, the whole process of assimilation is a real thing. And I think my father really struggled with that in various ways, but he made a big point of telling my brother and I not to forget where we came from. He only went to the sixth grade. He had to quit school when he was 12 and because his father died and he had to help support the family. But he was a really smart man, and his whole dream for my brother and I were to be educated. But he made a big point of saying, don't forget where you came from. My mother and father were very unusual people, and both of them were self-educated, but they were really interested in art. And my mother had a friend when I was young who was an art dealer, and they collected art. And it's really interesting, the Italian-American thing in art, because when I went to graduate school, I was part of a cohort of 15 people, and 7 of us were Italian-Americans. And the other 8 people, all their parents hated the fact that they were being artists. And all of us Italian-Americans didn't matter. Like, some people were really blue-collar, some people not, but all of them, the parents were like, yay, you're being an artist, that's amazing. So that, I think there was a receptivity to the creative life that was cultural. And just even before we were born, my parents' dates used to be to go to the opera or to go hear Rachmaninoff piano. You know, there's a famous story of them meeting on the steps of the war memorial to see some classical concert. And, you know, these are two people that didn't have a formal education, but culturally that was part of everybody's background. And, you know, sort of like Moonstruck, going to the opera. My father, I'm not convinced that he really knew how to write, like to write a letter, but he was an avid reader. And our house was full of books. And my dad was probably the most can-do person I've ever met. And he just sort of invented himself. So I do think there is a thread between that and my sense of, I'm just going to do this and I'll figure it out. And I'm sure that really came from my father, because he was very courageous in solving life's challenges. And our entire family benefited from that. I'm going to read everything that's not nailed down. I want to do this. I see this thing over here that I want to do, and I'm going to teach myself how to do that. So that's where I come from in a deeper way. But now I've been living in Portland since 1985. And really have grown up as an artist in Portland. Well, I went to the University of Montana, which was sort of a quirk. I happened to be there, and I was there teaching in their preschool, and I saw what was happening in the art department next to me. And part of my job was that I could take free classes, so I just started taking art classes. And also they had an amazing poetry program. So I was taking poetry, art, and performance art there. And I think my two biggest mentors there were Dennis Voss and Rudy Audio, who both taught in the ceramics department. But Dennis started a performance art class there. And he had another colleague, Pat Zents, who was a graduate of the University of Montana. And Pat Zents is like this incredible conceptualist. And he had a 10,000-acre cattle ranch. And our performance art class would go over there and do these actions on this giant landscape. And Dennis was the person that was really pushing all of us to be conceptual, to be risk takers, to not think about our careers first, but to think about why we're doing things and about being willing to fail in order to eventually succeed. And then Rudy is probably a better known artist for most people. Together with Peter Volkis, he was sort of one of the founders of the contemporary ceramic art movement. And when he was actually my MFA thesis advisor, and he had been around every block there was to be around, and he would say things to us like, Nanda, don't forget this is a lifetime's work, and you know, just keep working. And he would say these things that you'd think, oh, this is really simplistic, but then you're still thinking about it 35 years later. So I think he sort of had the wisdom piece, and Dennis had the piece that was saying, be aware of everything that's happening in the moment. The zeitgeist is something more than just what is trendy right now, and you need to be paying attention to that and processing that in some way that's authentic to you. And then I think I want to talk about Pat Zents a little bit too, because he was somebody whose artistic rigor was really an example to me. That he would look at things from every angle that there could be to look at them, and then distill all that down into something that was really pure and potent, that would allow viewers to see something that he experienced that they might not have ever paid any attention to otherwise. And he was a really interesting case because he was living in Laurel, Montana, which is like, I don't even know if there's a gas station there. It's so tiny. And he wasn't even in Laurel. He was in the middle of this 10,000 acre cattle ranch. And he was doing this just incredible, nationally recognized conceptual art on his ranch about the ranch. And he would make you experience those landscapes through his art in a way that was so powerful. So even though my work is really super different from all three of those people, I think it was their attitudes that influenced me the most.
Working at the University of Montana was clearly a pivotal experience for Fernanda. It gave her the rare opportunity to be taught by Rudy Audio, Dennis Voss, and Patrick Zents, who shepherded her interest in performance art.
Well, I think the first successful work that I ever did was as a performance artist. And this was in the 80s. And as I was saying, we had this performance art program at the University of Montana. And it was maybe there were a handful of programs at that time, but it was a successful enough program that high performance, the founder of High Performance used to come every year to see what we were doing in our program. And in the 80s, I think performance art, again, getting back to that narrative arc, wasn't so much about the narrative arc. And it wasn't so much about people being in a chair and looking at something on a screen, on a stage. It was more about artists embodying concepts and making their bodies part of a conceptual work. And that was really the direction of our performance art program. And I think between the year I did my thesis year and the summer of that summer, I spent in Italy, and then I had this performance art class for the two prior years. And it was those things, like weirdly, like the most crazy cutting edge stuff and this sort of historic thing that came together to make me want to do installations. Because we used to make sets for our performance pieces, and they'd be these sort of mini installations that then you would occupy. And you would many times have the audience occupy in a sort of choreographed way. And I think it was the confluence of those two things that made me want to do installation. Because I could take myself out of it and still have this sort of choreographed experience for the viewers, where they would be investigating a space. I think that Borderline is a kind of evolution from my previous work. After the election of Donald Trump, I had practically every artist I know this, I'm not unique in this, I had a kind of artistic crisis. It was very similar to an artistic crisis I had in 1968 for the same reason. And in that case, I was very young, I was a sort of baby artist, and I went away from art for 11 years. This time, I really felt, what can I do as an artist? And was, you know, really flummoxed. And I decided that I was just, my job was to look at things. And about that time, I got into an argument with an Italian cousin on Facebook. You know, Italy is going through some of the same things that we're going through with the divisiveness between the left and the right, and also over some of the same issues. And up until a certain point, Italy had been very welcoming of migrants. And Greece and Italy are receiving most of the refugees from Syria and also from Eastern Europe. You know, it's kind of the first place in Europe that people can get to. And there are these two tiny islands where they come. And my cousin, who I had only known as a lovely person, posted all this completely racist stuff on the internet. And it was all the same stuff, word for word, practically, that they had said about my grandparents and that I had heard applied to my father in the 50s. And to me, for that matter. But I mean, I was a kid, but I heard it from the kids on the playground. And I was just appalled. And I, you know, I can be feisty. And, you know, so I got into this, I wrote him and I said, you have no idea what you just did. And this is exactly what they said about your great aunt and your cousin, who I know you loved. And this is, you know, this is terrible. And he really pushed back and we sort of got into it. And then I realized that, and he said, you don't understand what's happening here. And I said, well, fair enough, I don't. So I started looking for, and you know, I'm a video artist, so I started looking for a video about the migrant crisis in Italy. And I found all this stuff from the Italian Coast Guard, where it's just like soul crushing, the desperation of the people that were crossing the Mediterranean. So that was one piece. And then I was also really, really concerned about the climate crisis. And I use a lot of archival footage in my work. And I started looking at the Internet Archive. And also, not everybody knows this, but anything that the US government creates is open source. So I started looking at the Forest Service fire footage from, because even 2 years ago, we were already getting into these sort of cataclysmic fires. So I was looking at that. I was looking at NOAA for extreme storms, and I was just downloading all this stuff. And I also was very scared and about surveillance culture. So there's sort of all these ways that the government is using video to keep tabs on things. And some of the ways are really positive. So, you know, we all love the Forest Service and NOAA. And then some of the things are a little more sinister. And I just started downloading all this stuff. And like I watched every migrant video that was on the internet. And I felt like my husband's father is a Holocaust survivor. And they always talk about people looking away and, you know, turning away. And I thought, I'm not going to turn away at all. I'm going to look at every bit of this stuff, which was really upsetting, but I felt like somebody has to look at all this. And it was really interesting because some of these things that are on, that are coming through, the things that have made it through the filter, you know, they might have had like 20 views. So you can see people haven't been paying that much attention. Anyway, I didn't know what to do about all this stuff. I was just looking at it. And then I decided, I took a class on mapping, video mapping, at Make Think Code at PNCA. And at the end of it, I had brought this hard drive with all this stuff on it that I'd been collecting. And at the end of it, we had a chance to map a bunch of things onto the ceiling of the place. And I didn't really think about how all these things went together. They sort of seemed like they went together to me. But when I saw them all together, a light bulb went off over my head and I realized how they related to each other. I realized how they related to each other artistically or as a visual montage, but I also realized how they related to each other in the world, that the climate crisis is driving some of the conflict that we have right now, and that that's driving some of the unprecedented mass migration that we're having right now, and that I think the most interesting thing for me as an artist is how my medium is being used both for the good and for the sort of sinister observation of all this. So I wanted to try and bring some of that out. Well, the last major project that I did before this one was called Generativity. And that really was focused on climate change. And I was using some of the same footage that will be in Borderline, because Borderline is sort of carrying that idea of climate change forward. And what I wanted to do with Generativity was to make people feel that our bodies and our physical presence on Earth is not separate from all these other things that are happening. And so that if we're implicated in all the things that are happening, and also all these changes have implications for us as living beings, and that we're not really separate from all of the rest of life that's being impacted. So that was sort of a gross simplification of generativity, but that was the idea there. And in Borderline, I think I've expanded on that to, with the forest fires getting ramping up and getting worse, and also just the sense of hopelessness with Trump, that, you know, we don't have any time to waste, and we're wasting all this time, you know, dealing with this crazy man. And how do all these things intertwine? And where are we in all that? Because I think it's one of the things that I find most distressing and worrisome, and I think this has to do with being the mother of a granddaughter of a Holocaust survivor, is you just hear all these stories about how people went on with their lives and, you know, sort of went, oh, that's happening over there. And I notice that with myself all the time, that I'm trying to change things in my life to be less complicit in all the bad stuff that's going on. But I think it's really too easy to look at something happening in California and it's just another show. Or, you know, it's separate from me. And that's part of what I'm trying to do with these pieces, is to put people inside of these things and make them feel that all of this is happening on their watch, to them. And I don't want it to be too scary, but I want people to think. And I want everybody to have their own experience too. It's not like it's so message driven, but different things are going to resonate for different people. And I had a Borderline has several parts to it. One of the parts was at Disjecta and just closed a few weeks ago. And I was really affirmed in what I was trying to do when another artist who I really respect, Malia Jensen, she posted something about my show on Instagram and talked about how she had had this really emotional experience with it. And that's what I want. Not that people are going to be coming away with a whole lot of thoughts in their head, but that's good too. But mainly I want the emotion. You know, I'm Italian, I like passion, but I feel like emotion, you know, if you say you were so moved, then maybe you will move. You know, maybe you'll move in your life to doing something a little bit with a tiny bit more awareness. And that could be different for everybody. But I think that's what I'm after, is that feeling of emotion. And I realize that's probably not super cool as a contemporary artist. You know, we're not supposed to be going for that.
Fernanda's interests and global concerns are very relatable, but they make even more sense when you consider her family's background. One thing that Fernanda mentioned that I wanted to circle back to was her husband's connection to the Holocaust.
Well, my husband's father and whole family were refugees from the Holocaust in Germany, and they escaped. They escaped the night before Kristallnacht. My husband's grandfather had been a well-known jurist in the Weimar Republic, and he still had colleagues that cared about him. And they had, and this sort of circles back to the, like, this isn't really happening idea, because they had hidden three of the children in Belgium in boarding school. And then they ran out of money because Jews weren't allowed to work. So the three boys were back in Germany. And they had told themselves that this will pass. This is where it's a civilized country thing. People have gone temporarily crazy, but this is where our lives are, and we're just going to ride it out. And they got a phone call in the middle of the night saying, your lives are in danger. You need to leave your home now. And they thought it was a prank call. And so everybody went back to bed. And an hour or so later, the phone rang again. And it was the same voice saying, I realize you think this is a joke. I can see that your car is still in the driveway. You really need to leave now because your lives are in danger. So at that point, they did leave, and they went and hid. They had a cabin in the forest, and they went and hid there. It's a really convoluted story, too long to tell here. But in the process of their flight from Germany, one of the children died because they couldn't find a doctor that would treat a Jewish child. And, you know, that really reminded me of what happened just recently with that 7-year-old girl at the border who was denied treatment for hours. And that's, you know, more or less exactly what happened to Erwin. Sorry. I mean, it's just become more and more emotional for me as I see history repeating itself. And I never dreamed that the United States could be, well, I mean, that's naive too. We've always been this cruel. I guess maybe it's the sort of unabashed cruelty that I haven't experienced since the 60s. And of course, we know that it's always been there. Especially people of color know that it's always been there. And now that so many people are unapologetic. Anyway, that's a history that our family really lives with. And there's a whole thing about, and this will circle into my collaborators, because I have some important collaborators for whom this is a much more immediate feeling. There's an idea that people are talking about now about embodied trauma and also generational trauma. And I can see with my husband in particular the impact of generational trauma. And if you were to meet him, he's this like friendly, affable, joking, simpatico person. But having lived with him for 30 years, I can really see the impact of this generational trauma on him. And so there's that. And even though that story didn't impact me, I guess it has impacted me directly because my husband and daughter are in that lineage, and so the impact of that has been part of our family. And I don't think it's been a horrible thing, but it's definitely something that's been part of just our emotional dynamic with each other. My husband's grandfather kept a diary, and he started out by talking about they had been to a concert, and they came home and got this phone call, and he says the whole thing that I just said about, you know, riding it out, and this is a civilized country, and this is an anomaly. And then the end of the diary is him throwing he had gotten the Iron Cross, which is sort of like the Medal of Honor for his service in World War I. And the end of the diary is him crossing, can't remember which river it was, but one of the, you know, iconic rivers of Germany, into Belgium, and throwing his medals out the train window into the river. And then they became stateless for a while. And at that time, and this sort of has to do with my history, and this is something I think people need to know more about. There was the Immigration Act of 1924, which outright banned Asians from immigration to the country. And then Jews and Southern Europeans the spigot was turned down to like a drip. So what the law was for Jews and Southern Europeans was that it could be 1% of the number of people that immigrated per year prior to 1880. And of course, 1880 was the year when immigration from Eastern and Southern Europe really picked up. So reading the language that's in that bill, it's all this stuff about the mongrelization of the race and biological criminality. You know, it's like totally racist if you go back to the congressional record and see what people were saying. And so, you know, then you get the famous incidents of people being turned away, the ship that tried to dock in Florida and was turned away. And then wound up, you know, most of those people died in the Holocaust. So it's like we keep coming back to these things. And I think assimilation, there's this push to forget all that. And this kind of also circles back to my dad. That was one of his mantras: don't forget where you came from. Don't forget where you came from. And you know, I can sort of hear him saying at the same time, you know, my brother's a pretty famous philosopher, and him saying, I'm so proud of you, but don't forget where you came from. And that's another thing that I'm really super grateful for, because I feel like a lot of people, there's this whole idea in the United States of the new man, you know, and that you're going to erase the past and you're going to become the new man or the new woman. And I feel like that's really dangerous to forget these things, because, I mean, I guess there are people who remember all that and then somehow do some sort of mental jujitsu and think, oh, it's okay if I do it to those people because they're different. But I feel like if you remember that these things have been said about you, done to you, that maybe you will have more empathy for the people that are experiencing that right now. I started working on this before the crisis at the border. And I got started with it. I was more driven initially by the crisis in the Mediterranean, because that was something that was directly implicated in my family. You know, I'd gotten into this big family argument. And then our border crisis really blew up. after that. But the idea of the borderline for me is not so much tied to this idea of a physical border between countries as it is the idea of a tipping point. Sort of like borderline insanity or borderline civilizational collapse or borderline environmental catastrophe. The idea of the borderline for me was a lot bigger than these sort of topical things, although the topical thing is part of that. So I needed to say that because I've been calling it borderline since the early 2016, and then all of a sudden these border issues on our southern border are like this big, huge thing. And I wanted to be just clarify that for me, where it started was much closer to home for me personally, and then also that it's a bigger idea for me that contains these other ideas.
Borderline civilization collapse is a resonant phrase considering our political climate, but it's certainly nothing new. As we've stated in previous episodes, decolonization is a major theme in this exhibition. And although not all of the artists have indigenous ancestry in North America, Fernanda is certainly aware of the connections between her work and those who have been displaced.
Assimilation is something that applies to everybody. I think it's hard for me as a white person to talk about decolonization because even though I experienced pieces of what, you know, when I was in the Immigration Act of 1924 wasn't overturned until 1965. I was 15. I was still officially an undesirable person until I was 15 in the eyes of the US government. So I think, you know, and the last time somebody implied that my father was a criminal because of him being Italian and a successful contractor was yesterday. So, you know, I have experienced bits of prejudice, but on a completely different order of people of color. I cannot presume to speak for anybody else but my own feelings around these things. But, and I want to say that the border crossing material that's in the project comes from both our southern border, the Mediterranean crossing, and crossings between Eastern Europe and Western Europe. So there are a lot of different crossings that are happening. And that's important to me because I'm trying to look at this as a more universal phenomenon of people being forced to move around, of people of all kinds being forced to move from one place to another. The place where I think there is some intersection with indigenous issues is the crossing at the southern border, because I've heard that, and this makes total sense to me, that many of the people that are making that crossing are indigenous people, and their historic use of the landscape has been to just flow freely. So I don't presume to speak for them at all, but I think just the fact that that footage is part of this sort of touches on that a little bit, along with crossings that are being made by other people in other circumstances. The idea of the map is not the territory. It is really interesting because I think I've been talking about this sort of dividing. This is happening over here. This is happening over here. These things are separate. And I think the idea that we can separate ourselves from each other and from what's happening in the landscape and from what's happening to other peoples and other places is becoming, being demonstrated to be more and more false. and that these kind of arbitrary dividing lines, whether they're psychological or territorial or jurisdictional, you know, I think they worked for a while for people. You know, maybe the nation state was an evolution from what we had before, but it's not really working anymore, because even if you're not somebody that believes in globalism as a concept, and globalism, of course, is really, really fraught because it's all wrapped up with laissez-faire capitalism. So, you know, that's one idea of thinking globally that has become really problematic. Another way of thinking about it would be thinking more holistically, thinking more about if this is happening to somebody else, that hurts me as well. You know, if something's terrible happening to some other person or group of people, that is an injury to the soul of the whole country. And if we're destroying the landscape that sustains us, I mean, there's the practical destruction, but there's also the destruction of this sort of, you know, the land is sustaining us physically through food and air to breathe and water to drink, but it's also sustaining our souls in a lot of ways. And if we destroy that, it's really self-destruction. So, you know, maybe that's the map that's the most problematic, is the map that says humans are some special category of being that's detached from everything else. Maybe it's that mental map that places us apart that's really the most destructive. And if we're thinking about the territory, we're thinking more environmentally and more holistically.
Fernanda clearly puts a lot of thought into her work, but she would be the first to admit that she couldn't do it by herself. It's her collaborators who make Fernanda's ideas come to life.
My work has always been really super collaborative, and I feel like with Borderline, all the pieces of Borderline, could not have happened without extensive collaboration. And for the last year and a half, I've been collaborating with Jaleesa Johnston and Sophia Wright M.A., and they are both performance artists and movement artists. And Jaleesa has a visual arts practice of her own. Sophia's a filmmaker. We met as part of a study group at Open Signal called Future Forum. And I had known Jaleesa a little bit before because we both had a show in the same venue, or had shows one right after another. And I saw her performance work and she saw my video. And she saw my video and thought, that's what I want to do. And I saw her performance work and said, oh my God, I haven't seen like a performance that moved me like this since 1985. So we had a sort of natural attraction to each other. And at Future Forum, Sophia and Jaleesa were interested in collaborating with each other about embodied trauma. Because Sophia, like my daughter, is the granddaughter of a Holocaust survivor. And Jaleesa is African American. And we worked together on a piece at Open Signal that was only up for one night called In Body. And that was a bit of the nucleus of the installation that will be at the museum. They, for the most part, the figures that people will see in the installation are Jaleesa and Sophia. And there's also one scene in each on each scrim that are the cast from the Portland-based cast for from the performance from Generativity. So I need to mention them too, but I won't go into too much detail with that, or we'll never get through this. Anyway, so Sophia and Jaleesa and I have really formed this team to be working on these ideas of embodied trauma. And I feel like that's really informing borderline, that's sort of the fourth thread of the things that we talked about before, the climate change, surveillance, and mass migration. And then the fourth thread is, how do you experience this as a body? And that fourth thread really emerged from our collaboration. Another important collaborator is Guillermo Galindo. He composed much of the sound that's in the piece. And Guillermo is a Mexican national. He teaches at the California College of the Arts now. And we were put together in an arranged marriage by a curator, Justin Charles Hoover, in San Francisco for a performance at Safe House. And we only met each other once before the performance. And I had to program a whole interactive creative code thing for this performance after this one meeting. And I think we were both sort of amazed at how it all came together. And Guillermo was really interested in what I was doing with the found footage of the border. And at the and he's actually like way, way, you know, if you're thinking about the art world, he's a much more known quantity than I am. He was in Documenta in both venues, and he's just, you know, getting a lot of acclaim right now. But at the end of it, he said, oh, I really hope we work together again. This was fantastic. And we're the whole crew of us in the San Francisco show were sort of amazed at how we pulled this thing off. And so when I was developing the work for Borderline, I thought of Guillermo and what he had said about hoping to work together again. And I wrote him and said, you know, I'd love to do this together, and I've got a little bit of money for this project, and can I commission you? And he wrote back right away and said, oh yeah, I'd love to do that. And I'm very happy because he's going to come up and give a live performance as part of The Map Is Not the Territory. And he is an amazing artist and also like the most simpatico person ever. So I'm really thrilled to have his participation. And then there's a whole host of other people, the cameramen and women from Open Signal. You know, I could go on and on about my collaborators. And I think there's a sort of myth, and I guess this also gets back to that making a border thing, where people, there's this myth of the genius individual artist. And in my case, I cannot do the work I do without a lot of other people's creativity.
Thank you for listening to the Portland Art Museum podcast. Relevant links can be found in this episode's description or at portlandartmuseum.org/podcast, where you can also find a full episode transcript. On the next episode, we'll hear from Henry Chung, a multimedia artist from Vancouver, British Columbia. This podcast is produced by John Richardson on behalf of Portland Art Museum. If you have an idea for a podcast episode, fill out the form at pam.to/podcast idea, and we can help bring your idea to life. I'd like to thank Fernanda D'Agostino, her collaborators, and thank you for listening.